Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, listening to the music of Chris Bode, who will be at UPH, the Universal Preservation Hall, on the 30th of this month, and so over the weekend, and at UPH.org, UPH at UPH.org, and the playlist is posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable, WAMC.org/roundtable. Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Wednesday edition. And our end of the week edition will be off tomorrow. We will be off Friday. This traditionally today, the day before Thanksgiving, is traditionally the day where we all feel, okay, let's just get this over with so we can get home and do all the things we have to do to get ready for for tomorrow. And today's show will be no exception to that. We have a wonderful panel, and let me introduce them to you. We'll get started. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I will say I was reminded as I was driving in this morning that I think in past years I've gone around the panel and asked everybody what they're thankful for, and I have realized over the years that it always ended badly. So we're going to skip that this year, unless you want, Nick. If you're like, you're really into it, you're welcome to it.
I feel like I have to go back and listen to past episodes on Thanksgiving Eve to hear the "it went badly" moment.
No, it's just, you know, things like, well, I'm thankful that I'm here today, but who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? You know, that kind of thing. Yeah, just like a little dark, darker than I had thought. So we'll just skip it. Judy Patrick is here, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. Wasn't it clear sailing on the way down this morning?
Oh, wasn't it nice?
Yeah.
It was great.
No traffic.
It was fantastic. No.
I thought this was a busy travel day.
Well, travel day, but it's not. Nobody's going to work, I don't think. Well, I mean, we all are, obviously, but state workers and the colleges and so forth are out. So, city workers working?
Yes, the city workers are working today. Still have to pick up the garbage and
do all that stuff.
So, thank you to all those employees out there working.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Judy, thank you very much. Nick Rangel is here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. A two-time winner of awards this past week. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We were very excited to receive the Local Impact Award from the Capital Region Chamber of Commerce for LASNY's great work across the Capital Region. And I'm very honored to receive the humanitarian award from Albany Law School's Alumni Association.
Very nice. Well, congratulations. Certainly well deserved. And it's wonderful to have you here and to celebrate belatedly.
Thank you very much.
Would have rather celebrated with you Friday, it sounds like.
The after awards were a good time.
The mayor of this beautiful city, City of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, is here, and we are always happy to have her. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. And while I know we have things that we've got to do when we're done, I'd like to think that we are helping your listeners enjoy the morning as they go about preparing for whatever is coming to them for Thanksgiving.
So, yes, and however you mean of preparing what's coming.
Yes.
Yes. that's right.
I left that open on purpose.
How many days left?
35, I believe. Wait. Let me check. I have a countdown on my phone. Yes, 35 days.
The mayor is ending her time, and Dorsey Appleers will take over the office, and
so we're transitioning, and I'm cleaning out my office and getting prepared for whatever's next.
Excellent. Well, congratulations, and it'll be wonderful. Dorsey, of course, was a longtime panelist on the program. She left to go
to run for office.
Run for mayor, yeah. but we congratulate her. It's wonderful to have another alum be in the mayor's office. So we thank her for that. Also, Catherine Tan is here, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on Thanksgiving Eve.
It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you. Classes are that when did the semester?
Oh, I don't know. I'm on sabbatical.
Oh, that's right. Oh, that's right. You are on sabbatical.
No, but I think they after Thanksgiving, Vassar students come back for like another week or two of instruction, and then another week of finals.
Yeah, that'll go
something
well.
Like that.
Okay, well, wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much. All right, let's get to what is going on in the news. A couple things I want to talk. Obviously, we'll talk about Russia in a moment, and because the we talked a lot about this over the last couple of days, and we spoke about it yesterday. Not a lot has changed, so we'll address it, but we'll take a moment before we do it. I would like to talk about the CDC because this is a story that we haven't covered in a while, and I think it's important that we do. Dr. Ralph Abraham was promoted and is now second in command of the Centers for Disease Control. During the COVID pandemic, Ralph Lee Abraham promoted discredited treatments like ivermectin, and as Louisiana Surgeon General halted the state's mass vaccination plan. So now, he has been named the second in command at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Department of Health and Human Services did not announce the appointment, and many CDC employees seemed unaware of it. But the CDC's internal database lists Dr. Abraham as the agency's principal deputy director with a start date of November 23rd, which was, of course, 3 days ago. The appointment was first reported by the Substack column Inside Medicine. A spokesman for HHS confirmed Dr. Abraham's new position but declined to comment further. Dr. Abraham did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Dr. Abraham's views on some issues align with those of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He has endorsed avoiding Tylenol in pregnancy except when absolutely necessary because of a possible link to autism. He's also backed ending routine immunization for hepatitis B at birth and removing from vaccine ingredients like aluminum salts, which are added to enhance the immune response. Catherine Tan, this is up your alley. What do you think?
To reiterate some of the points you just made, Abraham is a pretty problematic physician to be placed second in command at the CDC. He is an anti-vaxxer. He supported hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin as COVID treatments, even though there's no evidence supporting those things. He also endorsed avoiding Tylenol, which was, in the news a few months ago. So a lot of his medical beliefs do not align with what experts know and what research has shown. So it's really problematic that we have someone who is essentially a quack in charge of the CDC or having so much authority at the CDC. For me, the larger existential issue is what this is going to do to public trust in the CDC and other agencies under the Department of Health and Human Services. We're going to see some pretty far-reaching repercussions when you start filling these important seats with quacks and people who do not believe in the science that they're supposed to speak to and represent. So I'm especially concerned about what this is going to do to public trust in these agencies. Right now, I'm working on a research project with a former student who is now my co-investigator, and we're looking at Lyme disease prevention and specifically how researchers respond to public distrust, how they vaccine controversies of the past continue to shape the research that they're doing today. And recently we were talking to people, public health workers at the CDC, and one of the concerns that our participant expressed is, there are a lot of good researchers throughout this agency, right? These are people who are committed to public health and improving the lives of Americans and creating opportunities for people to stay healthy. And so their concern is, with all of these, these anti-science, anti-medicine people filling these important positions, what is this going to do to their agency? Like, people are not going to know who to turn to for reliable information. And that is a huge problem, right? So these agencies are supposed to be sources of reliable medical health information, but they are being corrupted and they really aren't reliable anymore. Just a few weeks ago, or maybe not a few weeks ago, maybe this is last week. My sense of time is not great. But recently, the CDC changed the language about vaccines, casting doubt on whether or not vaccines are safe and whether or not they are linked to neurodevelopmental conditions. And vaccines are safe, right? The studies show that they are safe and they do not cause autism. They do not cause developmental disabilities. But the fact that they changed that language on the CDC website is really concerning because this is what people are going to refer to for reliable information. So a lot of, the researchers that we have talked to in public health are really concerned because, if you have some of the CDC's website spouting misinformation, but then you also have a lot of important reliable information on the website as well, like, how is the public supposed to differentiate what they can trust and what they, should be wary of? And where else would they go if this, if this information has, or if these, if this website and the information they put out have been compromised? So that's, I think that's the larger issue here. And of course, even larger than that is like, this is going to result in people getting sick, people dying, right? So Abraham, when he was leading the health department in Louisiana, there was a whooping cough outbreak and he waited 2 months before warning the public. And in that time, like, two babies died, right? Mm-hmm. So there are real consequences to these things.
I think that to me, the other piece of this is, and again, we have an administration that is looking to deceive and distract.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have all of these decades of science being turned on its head, mm-hmm. that show that vaccines are safe and that have given really good, I think, health advice to parents and to doctors about how to keep their children healthy. And we're looking to undermine that,
mm-hmm.
and make parents doubt whether or not they should get a vaccine. At the same time, we have an EPA and an environmental policy that is saying we're not going to restrict fine particulates, which we know, mm-hmm. can cause heart disease and lung cancer. We are not going to put these restrictions on PFAS, these forever chemicals. We're going to allow you to burn coal. We're going to take away a lot of the things that we've created in order to prevent us from being exposed to chemicals that can have a neurotoxic
Absolutely.
Effect
yeah.
on us, that may actually be the reason that we're seeing an increase in autism diagnoses, mm-hmm. across the population, mm-hmm. that may be the reason that we have people, young people, experiencing higher cancer rates of certain types of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so rather than making us healthy again, it is really, for me, the audacity and the pulling the wool over average Americans' eyes and undermining trust in science at the same time that we're saying, but we're not going to look over here,
right,
at the things that most of us are afraid of. Most of us are concerned about exposures to chemicals for our kids. What should we be feeding our kids? The types of preservatives that are in our food. All of these things. We're going to deregulate that, and we're going to convince people not to vaccinate their kids.
Yeah. And
it's
these
horrifying.
And the things that you're listing, the different toxic exposures that are out there, things that need regulation, are not things that people have individual control over, right? So all of these exposures it's really up to like the government to regulate. And, you know, you're telling people, well, it's your choice if you want to vaccinate your kids. It's your choice if you take Tylenol. And a lot of the language that we're hearing from these different prescriptions coming from the CDC recently place responsibilities on individual Americans, right? But these are, at the same time, as you point out, at the same time, they are pushing misinformation. So people don't know, you know, with all the doubts and fear that is sown, like people don't know what to do. And it's such a vicious thing to do to American people. Meanwhile, as you pointed out, that's really important. Like all these other things impact our health, but we have zero control over it.
I want to go back. I agree 100%. This is a real concern that we're moving away from scientifically based vaccination mm-hmm. policies. But I think what is getting lost a little bit in the vaccination focus is the broader focus of Dr. Abraham's long experience in the medical profession. Actually, he was a veterinarian for a decade before he was a doctor. He has an MD, but is not board certified as a family physician. Mm-hmm. His professional experience is as a radiologist, even though he has done some family practice. He is not board certified as a family practitioner. And after 3 years in three terms in Congress, Louisiana created the Surgeon General title and appointed Abraham to that first role after leaving Congress as a co-leader of the Department of Health in Louisiana at a time when Louisiana then virtually banned almost all abortions mm-hmm. and then moved legislation to label abortion drugs like mifepristone as a controlled substance in order to criminalize the distribution of abortion drugs outside of what the state had allowed in its near total ban of abortion. And the elevation or the movement of Abraham from Louisiana in those roles up through the CDC, I think has a bigger, more broadly reaching impact. It is vaccines. He is clearly a vaccine denier, mm-hmm. whatever that, like, I don't even know how those critic words go together. a critic or like, you know, as somebody who is not an expert in vaccines, he says things that non-experts might say about vaccines, but he does it on a public platform. But he is pushing also an agenda that is anti-abortion and that could move the CDC closer to reclassifying abortion provisions, along with other kinds of healthcare that have been tested and proven safe for decades for people. I'm thinking hormone replacement treatment mm-hmm. for people who are transgender, right? We're seeing this crisis of leadership in the CDC that I do think is going to have widespread ramifications.
Mm-hmm. And also just how this will impact the way people perceive physicians, right? So not just their perceptions of the agency, but how they perceive the medical profession as a whole.
Politicizing exactly, medicine yeah. at a level that we haven't seen, mm-hmm. I've never seen.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from Judy and we'll continue the conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we welcome you as always. First, we have a break and then news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 26th day of November. Very nice to have you with us. We are talking about a doctor critical of vaccines quietly being appointed as the CDC's second in command. We've heard from most of our panel We'll go to Judy Patrick now. I just one thing that does strike me about this, and all of our panelists so far have talked about the great concerns here, but if you were proud of it, you wouldn't be quietly doing it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that interests me a lot is the fact that this was revealed via a Substack column that and was not part of an official press release. And in fact, a lot of what's happening at the CDC is an insidious attack on science and on vaccine at a time when, if you remember, RFK Jr. came before the Senate and promised he was not anti-vax. I'm not going to do anything like that. If you go to the CDC has a piece of its site that says where you can go and look and where to find a vaccine nearest you. If you go there, it's disabled. It doesn't work. They never announced that they were going to do that, but it's the subtle nature. And the medical societies, the American Academy of Pediatricians, the American Medical Society, they are doing their best to try to be the leaders, to put solid, reliable medical information out there about vaccines. But in addition to the insidious nature of the messages getting out to the American public, we have the overt messages. I mean, there are so many people in my life who blame their heart attack, blame the latest sniffle on their COVID shot, on their flu shot. And again, as someone who grew up, so thankful. My parents were so thankful for that polio vaccine.
Oh, I know.
Oh, yeah. Man. I'll take any vaccine headed my way. But we need to do a better job of educating Americans about who to rely on. Sometimes it's the medical professionals, someone with a little bit of medical information who maybe took biology in college, who will go on and say, well, the research says aluminum in the vaccines will give you, some sort of disease. Or the babies nowadays are getting too many vaccines. You're hearing this so often on social media that, and instead of the CDC being out there and correcting that information, they are subtly and sometimes overtly encouraging that kind of skepticism.
I mean, I think one piece of it is definitely educating the public, but that alone is not enough. And now, of course, that is completely compromised because you're getting all of these mixed messages and officials are casting doubt on medical information. But in addition to that, because something like vaccines, it is not, as we discussed while we were at commercial break, it's not really, it feels like an individual's choice. It's something that's talked about like it's an individual choice, but this is a decision that you're making not for just for yourself, but for the people around you, for your community, right? Especially when it's an infectious disease, it's your responsibility. And so I think this is where state policies matter a lot. The kinds of policies that we have in place to ensure that people do get vaccinated. So, I'm thinking about the policies that we have for school children needing to be fully vaccinated before, entering public school. Like, right. We need policies like that to ensure that people actually get the health care that they need. And it's, these are social contracts that we have with each other, right? It's really for politicians like RFK Jr. to say these are personal choices, it's a lie. These are not personal choices that you can make for just yourself or just for your child.
One of the things, and this is completely anecdotal, I want to label this as clearly anecdotal information, but in the pharmacists that I have talked to, and in my own experience of going to get the recent round of vaccines for both flu and COVID, the pharmacists tell me that they've had more people than ever coming in. And I think that's interesting. And I'm not saying that that solves the problem. It mm-hmm. certainly does not. But it is interesting to me that people are going against it too.
Yeah.
Are saying, okay, like like Judy and myself, frankly, of, okay, well, you have a shot for that? Go do it. Let's do it. Let's bring it on.
Hey, when they get that Lyme disease vaccination, I am not the first one in line.
I'm in, man. Yeah.
Well, and I think that, part of it is, I think, New York, right?
Yes.
And where we are.
Well, that's a great point.
And I think that's, you know, going back to, you know, what this individual who now has a national platform, mm-hmm. From a state with one of the highest maternal mortality rates anywhere, one of the highest infant death rates anywhere in the country, you know, where there are really bad health outcomes. And that is going to be setting the stage for what people all across the country who may not have access to the same type of information, who may not be hearing from local and state level health professionals about what they should and shouldn't be thinking about with respect to vaccines. And that is where I think you can do just a tremendous amount of damage.
You know, Tatiana Schlossberg's essay in The New Yorker, she's the granddaughter of John F. Kennedy, the president. She's the daughter of Caroline Kennedy. She has terminal cancer. And it was incredibly sad, incredibly well-written in The New Yorker. And part of it, she talks about her uncle, RFK Jr.'s assault on science, mm-hmm. and how it affects her and all the other, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are struggling with cancer, who are struggling to make decisions about vaccines. It did a lot to move the needle, I think, in at least in some people's perception about what is happening with the CDC at this point.
And I think the other piece of this is about risk. And I do think that we could probably do a better job of just looking at how do we talk about risks, right? So, you know, every time I get in a car, I'm risking that I could get in an accident. Anything could happen, right? But I'm making the decision that it's more important for me to get mm-hmm. to where I need to go and so I'm willing to assume that risk. And I think in healthcare, we do have to do a better job of talking about that risk mm-hmm. because with every medical decision that you make, there is a risk. There is a risk that you could have an allergic reaction, or there is a risk that you might be the 2% of people who have a particular side effect with respect to a medication that you're put on. There are risks associated clearly with cancer treatment. You know, my brother, you know, had chemo, and he now has almost no feeling in his feet, mm-hmm. right? That is a side effect of the chemo, but he took that risk because he wanted to live, right? Because the benefit of the chemo outweighed the risk of developing, yeah. what is it, neuropathy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yes, everything comes with a risk, but telling people not to take that risk is not protecting them. And matter of fact, it's putting them in more danger.
Yeah.
Just as if my brother had said, oh, I don't want to get neuropathy, so I'm not going to do chemo.
But also making it seem like they are in charge alone of their own risk management. I think that is the problem, right? So, you know, doctors, they're not solely responsible, but, you know, family physicians need to, and this is the issue with like insurance. They don't have enough time to stay with their patients and to talk about things and unpack ideas, certainly around like things like risk management. And I think it's really important for doctors when they can to foster that trust and relationship with their patients so that they can communicate risk effectively. And people's risk perception when it comes to vaccine, to your point, Judy, is partly because vaccines have been so successful. You don't see polio, you don't see measles, you don't really see mumps or anything anymore, right? And so, you know, vaccines have become a victim to its own success because we don't see these diseases out in the world so much anymore. We think, oh, we're at low risk of contracting measles or whooping cough or whatever. So, you know, people are under this impression that they don't need the vaccine because it's not out there, but it will quickly be out there if we stop vaccinating.
Well, you mentioned your family member, Kathy, and I think of people who have real decisions to make, and they'll often go for a second or third opinion, and all that's like that's all Well, that's fair. I mean, you want to know what's best. You want to know what the ramifications are, what you're going through, you know, what could happen, what has happened in the past, what their experience is. But I'm just struck by, in this case, you know, those old commercials where they say 9 out of 10 doctors recommend that, you know, it's just like you ask anybody and they're like, oh, yeah, the first thing you do to it, at least I will again preface this, any primary care office I've ever been at, the first question they ask you is, have you been vaccinated?
And I think that the point about vaccines is that it's not just for the individual. Mm-hmm. It is to protect others, because there are people who are either immunocompromised or have certain conditions that they cannot get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And so for those individuals, it's important that everyone who can be vaccinated be vaccinated. I mean, this has just been such basic science. It's been backed up by decades of success. And to be undermining it, I always look at follow the money. But to me, they're typically, when you see people doing something, there is some sort of profit motive to it. I can't figure this one out. I'm stumped.
No.
Maybe somebody will.
There is definitely an industry behind vaccine hesitancy.
But right? How do you make money on vaccine hesitancy when you've got all of these pediatricians out there who only get paid, right, when people bring their kids in to get vaccinated?
So Andrew Wakefield, who is a large, important figure in anti-vaccination history. You know, his paper in 1995 on autism and the MMR, you know, we know there is no relationship between the two. But his paper on that really set the current contemporary climate for anti-vaccination discourse. But when he wrote that paper, he was being first of all, paid by lawyers of families who are trying to sue the manufacturers. And he also had a patent out for an alternative vaccine. And he was also getting ready to sell treatments for vaccine injury. So there is a whole other world, a whole other market of anti-vaccination related treatments and alternative vaccines and cures.
So you can still follow the money.
Don't invite me on here to learn things, but I love coming on your show because I learn something every time. Thank you.
We invite you on for whatever reason may come through. I mean, the other thing, too, though, is, again, anecdotal, but I mean, I have people that I know that I'm very close to, and you say, and I say, oh, I'm going to go get my COVID shot, and they say, "Oh, I'm not doing that this year. I'm out." And you say, "Oh, why?" And they say, "Well, I haven't gotten COVID." I'm like, "Well, maybe because you got the shot the last time." I don't know how you overcome even that. I mean, I do think there's a fatigue that comes with it as well.
I mean, a fatigue with like people having to get vaccinated and stuff all the time.
Yeah, and just talking about it and the schedule, and I don't know. I'm in Judy's camp.
Yeah,
you know, put up a sign outside the store that says we're offering it. I'm there.
I mean, access is definitely an issue. There are a lot of things that public health officials, if they had the resources to, they would, you know, take advantage of to improve access. So access is definitely an issue still, right? Even if you are insured or you can afford it, we have to improve access. And that's not just getting to a pharmacy, but people recognizing that this is something that they have to get in order to stay healthy, in order to, not get COVID and have the luxury of being surprised by the efficacy of vaccines. What's going on now, within these agencies and at the federal level, it's compromising all aspects of these public health initiatives.
Nick?
Yeah, I think it, you know, goes back a little bit to what Mayor Shane was saying earlier, as far as Louisiana having one of the worst health outcomes in the country. They're actually 50th, and they are the worst ranked in Medicare coverage and support because of the lack of access for many Louisianians and the poor quality of care available to people who are on Medicare in the state. They also rank pretty low on vaccination rates. They rank low on or I guess the highest on premature deaths across the country. And this is, you know, this is the Surgeon General that we're bringing into the national stage at the CDC. And I think all of these conversations come back to how are we changing the narrative around health outcomes, vaccinations, but also access to healthcare across the country. What and what does that look like in 5 years or 10 years when we lose that herd immunity because not enough people are getting vaccinated because we're, you know, tired of talking about vaccines, right? It's, I think there's a lot to be said about what it means to bring the leadership of the state who does the worst in healthcare to the national stage.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll tackle some of the letters that we've gotten in this topic. We welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on this 26th day of November, and we welcome you to the discussion. Judy Patrick, Nick Rangel, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and Catherine Tan. We are talking right now about vaccines and the fact that a doctor critical of vaccines has been appointed as CDC's second in command, that doctor being Dr. Ralph Lee Abraham. We go to the letters now and begin with John, in the spirit of an intellectually honest conversation, can the panel at least address the very real skepticism that many of us have about big pharma?
Well, there people should have some healthy skepticism, right? Because big pharma, you know, they produce a lot of the drugs and medication that we need, but at the same time, it's also a business and they have business interests. And of course, you know, we've been betrayed by big pharma before. And I think this is where it kind of, you know, loops back to what we have been saying about the problem of trust, trust in medical professionals and experts and researchers in this country. Is you need authorities to look to help differentiate misinformation from actual information, right? And so this is, I mean, this is something, you know, I wish I had a better answer for, but it is really difficult for average people and even myself to sift through all the information that's available to figure out, well, is this safe or not? And this is where we really have to rely and trust on the experts. And when you have, you know, policymakers casting doubt, that's when we really get into some trouble. But also the solution is not to swing in the other direction and go down the alternative route where there is zero evidence, right? Where there isn't scientific evidence backing up these alternative treatments and interventions.
And I also think that, you know, with respect to vaccines, you know, looking at where the profit margins are for big pharma, a lot of these vaccines are now generic. You know, they're no longer, you know, patented. And so, you know, I think it is very healthy to have that conversation with your doctor about any medication and really looking and peeling back what it is that you're being treated for. But with respect to vaccines for our kids, I think that the science is really clear.
Right.
And so, you know,
These are not new technologies.
No, no. And you know, look, I've never seen Big Pharma put ads, you know, on the air. Maybe they are out there in your feeds for vaccines. They're pushing lots of other medications. But I think when you look at particularly childhood vaccination and the tried and true, you know, flu shot, that this is just decades and decades of success in healthcare. We should be taking victory laps that we have this level of immunity that prevents people from getting really, really sick.
I mean, the only one I would counter with is Paxlovid, that was heavily, that it is heavily being advertised, but is, you know,
Right, but I'm talking about the childhood stuff.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. In, so I believe it was either 1995 or 1993. That was when we allowed direct-to-consumer advertising, and that was when...
Oh, those were the days. Yeah.
And that was the beginning of pharmaceutical companies advertising directly to the public, and I see that as a pivotal moment in the fracturing distrust in manufacturers, right? When they are selling medication alongside cereal, right? Of course, people are going to doubt pharmaceutical companies, right? Because now they're positioning themselves as any other business, and that has been really detrimental to trust.
I do think, I mean, right now, I think there's a real trust problem with the FDA and with the CDC, like labeling what's an appropriate option for your healthcare, but there are international organizations. The World Health Organization was critical of opioids early on in its spread of use, even though they were being distributed more widely and targeted through advertising and aggressive, campaigns with providers. But there are other sources, and you don't have to go to like Reddit threads to find like that weird off market drink that's gonna cure your toxins.
Let's go back to the letters. Ryan says, if one refuses flu or pneumonia vaccines without a contraindication, they will be refused a lung transplant if they have failing lungs. Same with hepatitis vaccines for those needing liver transplants. Then we go to Dan. Why bother with hearings for political appointees or judgeships when they just slither through questions, obfuscate, and straight out lie? Then when in the position, they go back on their words without any consequence. There should be penalties, says Dan. Then we go to...
There's a really robust process for administrations to collect basically background information on candidates before they move forward. It is true that people can say a lot of things in their actual hearing, but it's also true that there are entire staff teams whose job it is to build the profiles of appointees and to find that weird article they wrote in law school or that, you know, publication, that op-ed they did on some topic 20 years ago. There's a whole office that does that for every administration. And I think the notion that the candidates are pulling the wool over on the eyes of electeds is kind of misleading because every majority conference also has their own team doing that work. And people are not tricked as easily as we think they are. They are approving somebody with knowledge of that person's experience and background and positions and opinions on these topics.
Kathy writes, guys, or in this case, four women, there is not an increase in the incidence of autism. There has been a change in the definition of autism that directly corresponds to the increase numbers. Even the expert who is behind the diagnosis code changes has written about this.
Yeah, a lot of things motivate, a lot of factors motivate the uptick in autism. It's awareness, it's changing diagnoses, people feeling less stigmatized. It's also improved services. You know, if your child is diagnosed in many states, not all, you get pretty great services that are oftentimes free. And it's also adults realizing that they are autistic, but grew up at a time in which they couldn't get a diagnosis. And so now they're getting diagnosed as adults. But I mean, there are also other reasons, but those are some of the big ones.
Well, and there was a fascinating article about how our education system as it exists today leads people to be seeking more of these diagnoses because, you know, and look, I have a son who was always busy, is what polite people would say. And I took him to get diagnosed for ADHD, and the guy who did the diagnosis was an older gentleman, and he gave him all these tests. And then when we came in, he said, look, your son doesn't have ADHD. He would just be a really good farmer. If you could get up in the morning and do chores and work out all that energy and then go to school and then come home. And he said, you know, we're educating every kid today as if they're going to be an accountant. Yeah. Not everybody's going to be an accountant. Yeah. And so I do think, and I agree. I mean, yes, the diagnosis, it has changed. So yes, but there is an increase, right? Like, two things can be true. But I do think that that is also a broader conversation that needs to happen. You know, kids don't have recess anymore. They don't. Yeah. So anyway, that's another show.
Barbara writes to us and says, my adult grandsons insisted they were not getting the COVID and flu shots. And that is their decision. Fine, we said. We will miss you. We'll see you maybe in the spring outside. They got their shots. Happy Thanksgiving, Barbara.
See, we need more family bullying is what we
Yes, that's right. Good point. Good, nice pressure there, Barbara. We are going to take a break. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I want to thank all of you for being with us and certainly welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org. If you have any questions and you'd like to make comments on the topics we're discussing, panel at WAMC.org. Certainly happy Thanksgiving to everyone, and I hope you have a beautiful holiday. We will not be here tomorrow. We will not be here Friday. We will be back on Monday. So all of those discussions that you have around the table over the weekend, just save it up and bring that grief with you on Monday's show, and it should be a good old-fashioned barn burner.
What are you airing instead of the roundtable, too? I'm sorry. I was wondering whether it was going to be.
We have a wonderful selection of specials that we run. Many of them are every year. We run them every year, so it's tradition. And but as of names and correct days, I'm not comfortable.
What's the song that?
Oh, Alice's Restaurant.
Yeah, Alice's Restaurant. Yeah, I always love to hear that.
Yes, always important. All right, let's go to other stuff, and we welcome you again to join us. We'll talk about Russia. Trump pushes Ukraine and Russia on a peace deal, but key issues are unresolved. Trump projected optimism about progress, but Ukraine and Russia remain far apart about whether Kyiv should surrender additional territory to Moscow. President Trump projected optimism yesterday, even this morning, that negotiations to end Russia's war in Ukraine were making progress, saying there were only a few remaining points of disagreement after a week of breakneck talks, but he said he would meet with the leaders of the warring countries only once they were in the final phases of a deal. The decision to push off a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky dashed Kyiv's hopes that the Ukrainian leader could use a one-on-one meeting with Trump in the coming days to reset the dynamic of negotiations that many Ukrainians feel have been tipped in Moscow's favor. A senior Ukrainian official said earlier Tuesday that Zelensky hoped to meet Trump as soon as the Thanksgiving weekend. Trump's declaration appeared aimed at spurring both sides into compromise, even as the trickiest details of a deal remained unresolved. Ukrainians have said that only Zelensky is empowered to resolve questions about whether to surrender additional Ukrainian territory to Russia, a key Russian demand that remains politically toxic in Ukraine. That reporting from The Washington Post. Mayor Sherry.
Well, I think it goes without saying that we want peace in Ukraine, but I don't think that we want it at any price. And I don't think that Putin can be trusted. We know he can't be trusted. And I think very inconsistent flip-flop, sort of you get whiplash with the diplomacy as it's happening under Trump. And so I don't think we know what's going to happen an hour from now, much less if they have a meeting after Thanksgiving.
It seems that, you know, Trump was like riding high off of the Gaza deal from a couple of months ago, which is why he's like pushing for this. I guess, you know, we're not pushing for a Thanksgiving due date anymore, which I always, you know, which I thought was really weird. I was like, this holiday has no significance for Ukraine or Russia. So I don't know why you're pushing for this deadline. But yeah, it's, you know, what's the point of these, you know, past few years of, you know, of fighting and war if Ukraine is just going to surrender and give in to all of Russia's demands. And it looks like the at least the original 28-point plan was very much giving Russia everything it wanted, right? So it doesn't really make sense for at this point for Ukraine to cede over so much.
And you think of all of the war crimes that yeah. have been committed by Russia. And there are, I believe, hundreds of thousands of cases that have been filed in the international court against Russia for their war crimes, their aggression. And it continued with civilian apartment complexes being targeted mm-hmm. Just overnight.
Mm-hmm. It's just, and for me, it's so wild that that Trump, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but it's just so wild that the United States is approaching Ukraine with such a antagonism when we're supposed to be helping them, right? You know, we're one of the biggest donors. You know, I looked it up last night. $134 billion is what we committed to helping Ukraine, and after that is the European Commission Council, which comes in at $74 billion. So it's really, I don't know, sickening to see us kind of threatened to withdraw so much, right? Because we could really end this in a way that would harm the future of Ukraine quite a bit.
You know, I follow the news pretty faithfully. It's probably something of a problem. But even... these negotiations
we make out in the deal, but go ahead.
These negotiations have been so difficult to follow. They're like topsy-turvy. Yeah. At one point, you know, oh man, Ukraine's really going to take a beating if this goes through. And then in another time, you know, the president's mad at Putin. We have, you know, and then we have the European Union cut out, and we've got, you know, Rubio traveling to Geneva. It's I think this is all part of this crazy diplomatic approach that the Trump administration has taken that is similar to the art of the deal that he or some ghostwriter wrote about in his book. I mean, it's sloppy. It's, you know, we had reports over the weekend about a leaked document in which Steve Witkoff, Trump's main envoy, coaching the Russians on how to deal with Trump. I mean, it's messy. It's sloppy. It's and some Republicans, especially and some conservatives, might say, well, you know, if it gets the job done, then all's well. But the bottom line here is it hasn't gotten the job done, and thousands of people are still dying, both Russians and Ukrainians. And again, what it was all for? I do not have great hope for it. You know, the idea that there would be a Thanksgiving deadline reminded me of Donald Trump's. At one point, he had a Easter deadline for the end
for
of COVID.
COVID. Yeah.
It's like, yeah. I think he likes big events. So he's a showman, and that's the best I can say about it at this point.
But then also to have on top of all that, you have Rubio having to go out at several points and saying, well, we didn't cheat on the test. We didn't look at Russia's paper to come up with our plan. We wrote it ourselves. And that was a really difficult thing to prove, to which case it got whittled down pretty quick. Nick.
Yeah, I'm I'm really concerned with the continuing decline of our credibility mm-hmm. on the international stage. And I agree with Judy, the topsy-turviness of this particular series of negotiations has been particularly wild. I just actually looked up a timeline of all of the demands that have been made by the administration on Zelensky and then on Putin. And on August 13th, and this timeline is a CNN timeline. It only goes to August 13th. And in it, I'm just going to read this. Trump tells reporters that he hopes to have another meeting between Putin and Zelensky almost immediately, and that there will be very severe consequences for Russia if Putin doesn't agree to end the war during that meeting. Right. And so we just keep seeing the president make these empty threats without any substance, without any teeth, and then use Russia's peace plan as its basis for this 28-point proposal to go back to Zelensky and say, well, I guess Putin has agreed to end the war, kind of, only if you give up your own national borders and reduce your military. I mean, credibility is just so diminished in this.
Campaigning, he said, we can end this on day one. Actually, I can end it before day one.
Right, if you capitulate to Russia. And that, that's the big if. And I think that to the point being made here, this idea of the art of the deal, as I've said on the show many times, I do not think that Trump has a great track record with the art of the deal. He's bankrupted seven companies. Countries are not companies. And the stature of the United States on the world stage is not something to be toyed with. And our credibility on the world stage is not something that you want ultimately to be bankrupted because, I guess I didn't make a good deal. And so the safety of Americans is really at stake here. I know that this is about the war in Ukraine and about what is happening on foreign soil, but it does impact our standing, our credibility, and our ability to have partners around the world who help keep us safe, who help prevent that terrorist attack from coming to our shores. We share all kinds of top secret information and intelligence with other countries, and they share it with us. And so if this president, with his erratic behavior and this whiplash, as I've said, back and forth, trying to show that he's somehow this big deal maker, undermines that, it impacts our safety here at home. And that is something that, and the reason why I think people need to care. This isn't the art of the deal. This isn't about buying an airline and then bankrupting it. It isn't about buying a casino and then bankrupting it. This is about the safety of Americans here in our homeland that is at stake with a president who is undermining our credibility and the willingness of our allies to help us.
And the lesson we learned during World War II is the stability of Europe is important to us as well. And I think that is something that is totally lost on President Trump. He's in it for the win. Whether or not it's a genuine win or not is inconsequential to him. I think he does not understand that he has no historical knowledge of World War I or World War II and our role in maintaining the peace in Europe that is so essential to our stability mm-hmm. going forward.
Yeah, no historical knowledge and no foresight on what could happen if Ukraine loses these important, these key territories, right? And how that's going to impact the rest of Europe. It's wild.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Bernal writes, Trump was trumping up charges of treason against Democrats this week, and then we found out his own security advisors were being treasonous and giving Putin the edge in negotiating over Ukraine. Yet again, where are the consequences? Then we go to Peter, who says, I'm so tired of all of this. The U.S. and Europe should dictate to Russia what's going to happen or else. Russia deserves nothing. Then we go to Jared. Bottom line is we can't let a country change its borders by force. The invasion happened under false pretenses, and Russia's behavior being rewarded with a land seizure is a terrible precedent to set. That from Jared. All right, let's go over to another topic as we look to, we have about 10 minutes before a break, and I would like to talk about the national parks. Is this new or had this been in the plans for a while?
I don't know, but, I'm not outraged about this.
Really?
No. You look at in the city of Albany, we invested taxpayer dollars in a beautiful, wonderful new aquatics facility. And it is free to our residents. But next summer, when we open it up to non-residents, they will have to pay a fee. If residents of the city of Albany go to the Bethlehem Town Pool, we have to pay for the privilege of using that pool. I think that when you look at the fact that there is a rate for the same with our golf course. If you play golf at the Albany Public Golf Course and you're a resident of the city of Albany, you pay one rate and you pay a higher rate if you're not. So yeah. I'm not – well, I mean, you should say what it is.
Yeah,
we're assuming that people know what we're talking about.
No, I didn't know I was going to set you off like that.
It didn't set me off, but I just – I was thinking about it, and I was trying to find the rage, and then I thought, well, I do this too, so
well,
I can't
– I mean, I would argue it's different, but the National Park Service is introducing a digital annual pass that charges foreign visitors $170 more than the United States residents across the federal recreation system. According to a news release by the Department of Interior published Tuesday, in America, the Beautiful Pass will stay at $80 for U.S. residents and a cost of $250 for non-residents in 2026. The announcement of a digital pass available through the reservation site recreation.gov includes America First pricing. Okay. At some parks.
It sells.
Starting on January 1st, non-residents without an annual pass will have to pay a $100 surcharge to enter 11 of the most visited places in the system. Parks will charge the extra $100, include Acadia National Park, Bryce Canyon National Park, Everglades National Park, Glacier National Park, Grand Canyon National Park, Grand Teton National Park, Rocky Mountain National Park, Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, Yellowstone, Yosemite, and Zion. The release describes the introduction of a digital pass as the most significant modernization of national park access in decades.
I mean, I agree with this. I don't have any issue with this. I think what they should do, though, is if they're going to jack up the prices for non-residents or foreign visitors, they should reduce the price for U.S. residents because it's nothing is changing. It's always been $80 for residents, and now it's going to be $80 still. So I would, I'm like, okay, if they're going to upcharge for the, it's really, I think I looked it up. It's like 15% of visitors are from outside of the country. So I'm like, okay, that's
and I don't think it's gonna dissuade people from going.
So.
I mean, I think it's
they've made it all
it's
the way
like,
here.
think about how much it costs to go to Disney.
Yeah,
and you think about
well,
you
don't
have,
get me started on that.
But I mean, you have in-state tuition and out-of-state tuition. I don't know. I think it makes
national,
sense.
These are our national parks. They are what will bring people into to visit into this country. And I just don't. And let's face it. We as Americans are going to gouge these people at every chance we get throughout their trip here from the moment they arrive at the airport till the time they get back on the shuttle back. And I just think that if it's $80, it's $80. And I don't understand.
I totally disagree.
America First.
we're able to keep it $80 because they're charging more. I mean, we have to pay the people who work in our national parks. We have to ensure that we've got guides there. And, you think about they are a treasure. And if you're going to come here from a foreign country, I have no problem with you paying more.
I don't like having it said America first. It just seems, well, what is that? What does that mean? And I don't like that name of it.
Oh, sure.
And
it's a little propaganda-y.
But, yeah. But well, where does that get us?
What it actually does is fine. Calling it America first is a little icky because it makes you think, oh, it's they're trying to distract us from all the other ways in which
bring
they're
us
not...
your white people to Yosemite.
Yeah, can I weigh in on this a little bit?
Yes,
because,
please.
So I spend some vacation time in Europe, and whenever we go to some of the major places, I go with my French friends, and often I am charged more because I am American, and my French friends, who I love dearly, will smugly say, that's because we pay European taxes. And I said, well, what about the Marshall Plan, which they have totally forgotten about? And so what it leaves me with is, as a tourist, a bad taste in my mouth about this. I think, oh, they don't really want me here. And so I am a little upset. But can I also make a pitch for the senior pass for the National Historic Parks for $80, a one-time cost of $80. If you were a person of mature age, it's in the 60s someplace, you can get a lifetime pass to all national parks.
And with your family.
With your family. Haul them all in there. Yeah. And it's the greatest deal in the world for U.S. citizens. You know, so as long as the EU is doing it to us, I guess I'm okay with us doing it to them.
I don't know. And when I travel and I get the visitor tax or whatever, I'm like, all right, this checks out. Yeah, I'm okay with that. I made it all the way here. And it should be more affordable to their own citizens. I get it.
Nick, I'm fascinated. Yeah.
What do you think? All right. I, too, am okay with a surcharge on tourism. But here's my take. It's a little bit different. Increased traffic to localities costs localities money. It's infrastructure, it's emergency services, it's higher housing costs because of Airbnbs, especially in places that haven't yet adopted, any kind of additional fee for Airbnbs. And having a higher surcharge can offset some of those costs in those localities and small towns, especially around national parks that have a lot of rural regions that otherwise have a hard time recouping that cost. What I will say, and the one concern that does come to mind with quite the jump in the surcharge, is that attendance or visitation to the national parks by foreign tourists has already dropped from 30% to 15% in the last 5+ years. And so I would be concerned about fewer tourists because those same towns really do rely on tourism at the same time. And so I would want to see a real data analysis. Does this reduce traffic or does it actually improve services in those parks? It is at the same time as the federal government is cutting resources and funding to those national parks and seeking to remove portions of national park from protection in order to, capitalize on private resource development. And so it's also possible that the increase in fees doesn't actually help the park that much at all because they've cut so much somewhere else that it just kind of neutralizes those cuts or maybe those parks still see reductions.
Well, first of all, so many countries don't even charge to go to the national parks. But for foreign tourists, here are the countries that charge: Thailand, Rwanda, Tanzania, Chile, and Ecuador.
Those are national parks. But I travel, like Judy, we non-residents pay higher rates for lots of things, museums, visits into palaces. I mean, the non-resident rate, whether it's foreign or not foreign, but it's a non-resident rate, is pretty common in a lot of tourist cities. And I mean, there's tourist cities that don't want tourists. So, we're seeing higher costs.
Right. Well, we want their money. Right. Come and get it.
No, but there are. This so I don't
it's like congestion pricing
and look
yeah,
I think
for parks
I understand what you're saying about America first, but I do think that there are some things that residents rightfully expect to have a priority on. And so, again, residents of the city of Albany expect to have a priority with respect to access to our recreational facilities, especially when they are charged to use those same facilities when they go to our surrounding suburbs. And so I don't think it's a bad thing to say, I'm going to set up a fee structure to help support this infrastructure, be it a community center or pool or whatever it is, so that my residents who paid for it with their property taxes, paid for most of it with their taxes, have an advantage and have a lower rate than those coming from other communities who, yes, we want their support. We want them to come play golf. We want them to go to the pool. But their taxpayer dollars did not build this infrastructure, and we're going to charge them a little more.
I understand. I agree with you on what you just said, because I do think when it comes to priority, yes, the people who are paying, the people who are giving the money. We got a break here, so we'll take a quick break, and then we'll continue the conversation. But I think that is okay. I just then to take the next step of you'll have priority as a resident, but and then we will have so many slots available. Fine. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We are fighting / talking about national parks and announcing their America First upcharges for foreign visitors. You wanted to make a point right before the break, Nick.
Yeah, my point was just that the many of the national parks on this list, maybe all of them, I would have to confirm, but they experience such crowds that there have been reports of 3-hour wait times to get in through a gate to get into some of these parks. You have to have a timed entry pass that you've been on a wait list for months, maybe years. Rafting, the
Bryce Canyon?
Grand Canyon. Okay. It has a wait list of several years to get a permit to do that. And so, there is some... I get your meaning. You could prioritize residents for those permits and entrances or entrance fees, but when you're just standing in line for 3 hours, how do you know who is the resident and who is not the resident in that 3-hour line? It is the fees that may help move residents up that wait list. Just saying.
All right. So here come the letters.
What do the people say?
Here's what the people say. Anne Marie, I went to Canada for 3 weeks this summer. National parks were free for everyone. No parking fees, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, New Brunswick. This is a distraction to the absence of health care and affordable housing. Military investment is robust. That from Anne Marie. Then we go to this letter from Lawrence. How ridiculous that we will charge extra money to foreigners to visit our treasures. We can't show them off. Well, God put them there, not Trump. I've paid for them my whole life. Not every tourist is rich. This is personally disgusting, and I couldn't agree more with Joe. Thank you. We also,
I'm going to read over his shoulder.
I'll send it. Put it up on the screen. Let's see. James, remember when Americans in America were welcoming to others, immigrants and visitors alike? Can we go back to that time, please?
That has not ever been true.
That's a very good point. I agree with you on that.
False narrative as a Mexican woman.
Dan says, charging more is one thing, but these amounts for foreign tourists are outrageous. In the meantime, Canada has removed all fees from their parks for the next 2 years. For everyone. It's another reason why. Those damn Canadians. Dave says, as a recently retired 41-year National Park Service employee, I wanted to let you know that the money generated by user fees is targeted toward deferred maintenance projects, not ranger salaries.
What? But that's also important, right? Those facilities are important. The facilities make parks more accessible for people with disabilities. The facilities make it more accessible for people with other language access. It makes it accessible and safe to travel in spaces that not everybody has training in. I do a lot of outdoor recreation, and there's been a lot of advancements in helping make sure the outdoors is more accessible, but that costs money. And I guess we could all just pay our taxes, you know, some more than others who aren't right now paying taxes. Like, that's a great solution. But the notion of residency and non-residency fees is not just on its face objectionable to me.
And thank you for your service with the National Park Service. I've never had a bad experience at a national park with an employee. They are
not the employees.
No, they're wonderful.
No, the people who go there can be annoying as hell.
Well, yeah. But it's a great workforce, whether, you know, you're going down to, you know, visit Roosevelt's house or going to Zion. I mean, it's just, yeah. So thank you.
Brooke says, will all this extra money go to rehire all the park rangers who were fired? Do you really think this administration will put the new funds back into the parks? Then we go to Maya, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which I believe mentioned, charges non-New Yorkers more than New York residents. I know that's not a public institution, but I have no problem with this pay structure. I quite frankly don't either, by the way. But and Alice says, Nick points out community costs with tourism makes me wonder where these dollars are actually going to the communities? That from Alice.
Well, the previous writer said that they go to enhancing the facilities and deferred projects on site. So think the facility resources for campers, for RVs, for example, or campsite development, trail maintenance, wildfire prevention, training, education programs for youth and visitors. You know, parks are a really elaborate service to the public. I think of parks as outdoor museums in a lot of ways, and all of that costs money. Combating invasive species, preventing the spread of that weird beetle thing that's coming upstate, right? Like those are projects that cost money. Preservation costs money, and
it's not all outdoors, right? We have national parks down at Hyde Park, you know. Yeah. So these are some of them are historic homes and buildings, and you know, I think it's great if that's what it's really earmarked for. I just hope they're not.
Just hope it is really.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I really just think the message is we just don't want foreigners in our parks.
That's certainly what it sounds. I mean, that's what the president said that.
It's not that I don't want people from Colony in my pool. I just want them to pay more.
All right. Anthony Dunn writes to us from Garden Flat, London. And his is a long letter, but I'll try to shorten it up.
From London, England?
Yes, from London, England.
Oh, wow.
My sister-in-law is a member of the Council of the National Trust, the UK's leading historical homes preservation body. It is the UK's largest membership organization at between 5.5 and 6 million people, or about 10% of the British population. Being a trust member myself, I'm just about to propose that the National Trust institutes a special pricing and waiting list solely and specifically for U.S. residents. I think it's called going to the back of the queue. Having encountered quite a few U.S. passport holders during my own travels around Europe since November 24th, just about all of them have expressed a degree of horror at the xenophobia and tub-thumping a nationalism now on loud and proud display, even on the round table. So enjoy your increasing isolation.
No.
That from Anthony.
Okay.
All right.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes.
When I've traveled as a tourist, as a tourist who wants to contribute to the local economy, I have never been offended by paying a higher rate as a tourist because I'm aware of both my environmental and economic impact on that community by the fact that I'm taking up space where somebody else might be, you know, having an apartment instead of an Airbnb. Like, I do think there's a way to be a responsible tourist. And some of that means, in some cases, paying a higher fee to support that local economy. Even when I'm at conferences across this country, I make a point to spend my money in local restaurants and local businesses, because having a conference in the city of Albany is expensive. It costs us resources. It's wear and tear on that city. And I'm not offended by paying more to go to England. I would gladly pay the higher rate.
All right.
And we would love to have you here. And I think that there is a lot of this whole America First thing, you know, that's why we need to be going to places and traveling and saying to people, you are welcome here. This is noise, and it's a minority. It's not the majority of people. We do want to welcome people from all countries here.
We are out of time. Happy Thanksgiving to all. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. I so appreciate your time and your insights. We will continue our program. We'll talk to Jan Brett next on the Roundtable.